Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second edition of the 2015 Front Stretch podcast series. My name is Matt Stalnick. Once again, I am joined by my fellow Front Stretch experts, Aaron Bearden and Mike Neff. It was a very, very interesting weekend in the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series. Quaker State 400 in Kentucky Speedway was the major race of the weekend for the Cup Series, and it was a wild show with a low downforce package that NASCAR brought to the track this weekend. Lots of passing, record number of lead changes, a three-year high in total on-track green flag passes. It was a wild show from start to finish with some passing late in the race. So we're going to dive right into that discussion. So, Aaron, we'll start with you. What were your thoughts on the new low downforce package?
Well, to be honest, I was just glad to see it on the track, Matt. We had so dang much rain early in the weekend, I was thinking we were going to have a boat race for a while, but once they finally got on track, they put on a great show. I mean, 2,665 green flag passes. The former high at that track was 1,147. I'm a little bit of a mathematician, so I threw together on the stats and found out that's a 132% increase. That's pretty insane, and honestly, just to be able to see passes in all three series in the final 20 laps for the win was just great to me. I mean, in the past at Kentucky, you've seen the leaders kind of been able to hold ground and not really have any, I guess, weakness for the guys behind them to pass. And so to see Busch be able to reel Logano in the closing laps and be able to put a move on him when he had a better car was honestly, just it made my heart happy because I wasn't sure we were going to be able to see that going into it.
Mr. Neff, what were your thoughts?
First of all, the fact that Kyle Busch was only 0.2 faster a lap and was able to not only reel in the leader but then pass him is an enormous step forward. And I will totally and unequivocally acknowledge that that is a fantastic thing. But I am not about to jump on board with all of this euphoria about record numbers of lead changes and passes. There were not one, not two, but three. Only three on-track passes for the lead out of the 13 lead changes that took place. And yes, there were only 13. I know somebody was spouting off numbers of 22, 25, something like that. Lead changes only count at the start-finish line. I'm not buying into loop data statistics where they talk about them everywhere that they occur on a track. I'm just not going there. And so it was a good deal. I was glad to see that most of the drivers liked the package. I was glad to see that it was more difficult to race than it has been in the past. I thought that was great. My one question I still haven't had an answer from anybody, and maybe Aaron can enlighten us since he was there. What was the logic of saying qualifying was rained out and then starting a practice for the race an hour before that qualifying was supposed to take place?
Aaron?
Well, when I was there, more or less, just to be honest with you, a lot of drivers were really freaking ticked off. I'm just going to be honest about it, because they only got, what was it, 45 minutes of practice before then?
That's correct.
So NASCAR was kind of stuck with their tail between their legs a little bit there, and they decided that giving these teams practice pretty much superseded qualifying, was my understanding of it.
Yeah, that's so you had, my understanding as well.
So you had three teams that spent however many six figures it adds up to that didn't even get a shot, even though the weather was acceptable to qualify. They couldn't have let them in the practice and decided to set the field on the practice speeds. They just said, no, you guys are going home. Thanks for your inspection fees.
Well, they did set the field by practice speeds in the sense that they used the first sessions. But when they set the field by practice speeds, it still goes by owner points, apparently. So that's why those three teams got left out. But you could also make the same argument for Thursday's activities when the Truck Series, they had the track dry, and the Truck Series could have qualified and maybe even practiced, but they chose to run an Xfinity practice session instead and throw the trucks on the track without a single lap beforehand.
Yeah. Again, I don't – I understand – actually, I don't even understand. I'm not going to lie. I don't understand it. Everybody's in the same book or in the same boat. They had a little bit of practice time, we all know that qualifying half the time is a glorified practice. So run a glorified practice, set the qualifying, at least give those teams a chance. I mean, we're in such a situation where there's four or five, whatever it is, major teams, and there's nobody else breaking into the sport, and you have these smaller teams that are doing everything they can to have a shot, and you don't even give them a second thought and just dismiss it out of the whole deal. I don't understand that, and I think it's shameful.
Yeah, I didn't understand that either, and this is now 2 weeks in a row where I personally thought that NASCAR really dropped the ball as far as qualifying is concerned. And the Wood brothers were, in particular, were screwed out of a position of the race, realistically, because we all know they would have qualified 2 weeks in a row. And when you have a team that is spending the kind of money that it's going to take to put a competitive car on the racetrack, which is what the Wood brothers would be doing, I should say, you're doing a disservice to the competitors. And it's frankly something that I'm getting sick of. And I mean, if we're going to go by practice speeds, why don't we just go by straight practice speeds? I don't understand some of the rationale behind, you know, letting a team that's an essential, cannot talk today, boys, start and park organization or close to it race over the Wood brothers. So it's something that goes all the way back into the most political and business sides of the sport that, you know, we're not really meant to understand, because there's really nothing to understand. It comes down to politics and a lot of, you know, questionable business decisions. So it's really sad, but it's been almost 20 years and we still haven't really figured out a good way to handle some of these rain out qualifying procedures. And it's frankly getting to the point where it's just ridiculous. So I don't really know what the best strategy would be, but we need something better than this. I would suggest if you're going to use practice speeds to determine how the running order of the field is going to start, then go by straight practice speeds. If you finished 44th in practice, guess what? You're not going to start the race.
Well, I don't understand the logic of using practice speeds, but number of attempts supersedes practice speeds when it comes down to provisionals.
Yeah, I don't get it.
I can understand provisionals for, you know, for past champion or something like that, which even then gets sketchy when you get these guys renting Terry Labonte to come out and race. But the fact that you have, amazingly, 46 cars show up for a Kentucky race, which is a pretty decent field, and then you turn three of them away when you had the opportunity. I can completely understand if the, you know, time for qualifying came and went, and then it was time for a practice. But the fact that qualifying was scheduled an hour after that practice started, and they basically just announced that, yes, it's rained out, makes zero sense to me. I just can't. I don't understand.
Yeah, it's pretty shameful. But the good news, the best news of the weekend is that the racing on the track at least silenced some of the demons because there was a lot of people that were very angry about this qualifying ordeal. And it was mostly an afterthought, believe it or not, by the end of the weekend, simply because of just how really solid the racing was. And just to put a period on this whole Kentucky rules package discussion, I was very satisfied with what I saw. I'm going to kind of go with what Mike was saying before. It was far from perfect. I mean, I still think there's a lot that I would still prefer to see in terms of the racing. It's really hard to describe this stuff in simple words, because when it comes to these rules packages, there's so much that goes into creating the perfect package. And if it's off by just a little bit, you know, a huge group of people is not going to be right or not going to be totally satisfied with the package. And then if you go a little bit too much the other way, you're going to get another group that's, you know, not very satisfied with the package. And that kind of brings us to our next discussion here. For anyone that was listening to SiriusXM Satellite Radio Monday afternoon during Dave Moody's show, probably heard, or most definitely heard, Brian France join the show and tell the entire world that he believes that there was not enough drafting and pack racing in the race at Kentucky. Now, I should qualify that by saying and also mentioning that France did say that he felt the racing was very solid at Kentucky. He was happy with the product. His staff was happy with the product. But he made a point to say that he wanted to see more drafting and pack style racing. Now, a lot of people on social media have been really running with this one, and a lot of people have been frankly unhappy to hear that that's what his thoughts were. I should qualify it by saying that there's a lot of different ways you can define pack racing. There's a lot of different ways that drafting can be employed on the track. So I would caution anyone before we get into this discussion, for anyone who's listening, to assume that France meant, you know, a 43 car wad like we usually see at Talladega where no one can really pass. But I mean, that's what was said, and I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on it. Mike, we'll start with you. What do you think?
I don't know. It's one of those things that there's so much doublespeak that comes out of his mouth sometimes that you aren't ever really confident that you know exactly what he said.
Yeah, that's what I would
say. With that, I'll say at least my vision of what he says about drafting usually goes down to the slingshot pass. And I'm all for slingshot passing. I think that would be an amazing addition to whatever kind of racing we see. Because I used to, when I first got into NASCAR racing in the 70s, that was prominent in the sport. You would often see slingshot passes, and being in the lead was a sitting duck. And that lasted all the way up until the 90s. I mean, even the near the late 90s at Indianapolis, you still had guys that when you were leading was the worst place to be. So if that's where he's going with drafting, I'm all for it. I think the ability to suck up behind somebody and use that added momentum to actually slingshot past them, I think that would add a whole nother level of strategy and technique and ability that the sport would really benefit from. So if that's his angle, I'm all for it. As far as quote-unquote pack racing, I don't know about that. I mean, I get frustrated watching them or choreograph these restarts with bogus cautions anyway, just so that they wad them all back up together so that they get them in a group. I think there should be room for them to work on the track, and if the drafting is involved to get people towards the front and working by people, that's fine. But I don't want to see continuous groups of three wide racing multiple laps after restarts.
Aaron?
Well, I'm going to start just by going back to France's quote. Going back to it, he was talking about we didn't see as much of that and we would have liked more pack racing. And he qualified it by saying that you saw it on restarts, but not quite as much as we prefer. So what I think France was talking about when he said pack racing was just a tight field, the field being close together, because the few times that we did see long runs at Kentucky, they were kind of able to spread out a little bit. So I think what France was really trying to refer to with the pack racing deal was just the field being, I guess, tight, where everybody was kind of constantly battling. I don't think he had like a Talladega 43 car wad envisioned in his head when he said that. So I'm going to qualify that and say I kind of understand where he's coming from there. I think he's trying to go back to like the late 90s where it seemed like there was always like one guy passing another guy on track. But I don't know how much more he can really expect from a track like Kentucky, because there were pretty much battles going on all night. And a lot of that did come down to what NASCAR did with the cautions, because there were a record 11 cautions, and I think maybe four of them were actually for crashes that I would have thrown the yellow for. There were some debris cautions. There was, like, I think Junior scraped the wall once and they put the flag out. I don't really agree with that. But overall, I don't really know what France is saying here. I mean, you never can tell with him. But if it's talking like Neff's talking about with the slingshot, then I'm all for it on the drafting side, just because I think that would add a whole nother layer to the racing. And with pack racing, if he just wants the field to be tight and battling, I'm okay with it. I just don't want to see 30 cars in 3 seconds and it just become a total. I don't even really call that racing. I don't know what to call that. I just want the racing to have some legitimacy to it and for the lead to still matter to an extent. Outside of that, if NASCAR wants to try to improve it a little more, more power to them.
You know, the funny thing is anytime pack racing is such a volatile phrase in this sport and in all of motorsports, it evokes a different, you know, it evokes a different reaction inside everybody's head when they hear that term. You get people that just sit there and they love, you know, that some of these rules packages we've had at, say, Daytona and Talladega that just stacked them up three wide by three wide by three wide where no one can move. And, you know, like I said, I'm a fan of restrictor plate racing, and that is not what I have ever wanted to see. You know, in terms of plate racing and specifically plate racing, I've always enjoyed the packages where the drivers can spread out a little bit more. They're still in a pack, so to speak, but they can move around. They can really utilize the draft and make some big moves. You know, handling is important. You know, we've talked about that on this podcast, you know, before. But I don't really think anybody wants that really going forward. Yet you'll get people arguing back and forth that say, no, we can't have pack racing. No, pack racing's fine. And I think some of the problem here is that no one really knows how to define pack racing, because it's like anything else. There's good pack racing and there's bad pack racing. Mike and I, you know, I think both echoed that sentiment last week. And I'm going to be in the same camp as you guys here. I do not in any way, shape, or form think Brian France is implying that he wants to see a 30-car WOD. And that's a WOD is what I refer to when I think of these styles of pack racing, like an IndyCar, for instance, in 2011, like at Vegas. That was a WOD. No one could move. No one could pass. You were pretty much just at the mercy of, you know, if someone was going to wreck. That's not what I don't think anybody wants to see. I don't think plate racing, real plate racing fans, I don't think want to see that. Intermediate track fans, I certainly don't think want to see that. So I would say to evaluate his comments, I think we just need to take him with a grain of salt. And I'm going to assume he wants to see slingshotting and loose packs of cars kind of running together. I don't think he wants to see, for instance, you know, one or two cars break away from the rest of the field and, you know, be 5 seconds ahead of everybody. I think in France's mind, if you had three or four cars that broke away and were in their own pack, and then maybe 5 through 12 was in a little pack battling, and 13 through 16 was in their own little pack battling, and everyone can kind of move around and pass and use the draft, then certainly I don't think anybody could argue that that would be bad. Now, the only question I have is how you're going to accomplish that and still kind of maintain the low downforce. I think there's ways to do it, but I think that's probably the next discussion if we're going to assume that that's kind of what he meant is, okay, how do we marry this low downforce idea and mechanical grip idea with the slingshot style passes? And I mean, I don't know if either one of you have any thoughts on that, but that would be my biggest question then.
Well, you know me, I'm all about taking everything off below the front bumper. I think if you get to that, you end up back with the 70s, which isn't going to get as big of a pack as we have, but it's going to give you, like you said, little groups that'll get together and they may be able to stay in line and run down another group. And it would require a lot of driver skill to keep them together. But if guys were good enough, they could get in their own little groups. And I think you'd get some broken up groups, but little groups would have their own battles going on. And depending on how the chips fell, some people might be able to pull one group up to another. And I think that would be a great thing.
But yeah, I think that'd be a lot of fun.
I don't know if we're going to ever get to that. I keep harping on them. One of these days, they're going to prove me wrong. But until then, I'm never going to shut up about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I've always kind of wanted to see on the intermediate tracks. And I've wanted to see a more intense version of that on the super speedways. My dream for the super speedways has always been maybe a loose pack of 10 to 12 cars, maybe even 16 to 18 after restarts that slowly kind of break up over time. And then you kind of have all these packs where, you know, everyone can really move around and make passes and all that stuff. And I think we just all want to see a version of that on the intermediate tracks where, you know, you have small packs of cars that can just, you know, the draft isn't the be all end all like it would be in a big WOD, but you can use it as a weapon. The draft should be a weapon. It shouldn't be the whole, you know, the whole style of racing that you're dealing with. And I'm going to assume that's what France meant.
Amen.
So, oh, sorry.
Oh, you're fine. I was just agreeing with what you were saying, man.
Oh, 10-4. Well, to put a period on that, I think hopefully over the course of the week, Mr. France clarifies that statement, because it's been a bit of quite a reaction on social media. For the final topic, however, for today, obviously the race winner, who we haven't even gotten to because there's been just so much to cover as far as this Kentucky race goes, was obviously Kyle Busch. Busch drove a heck of a race all race long, and it's really just been so impressive to see what Busch has been able to do in the wake of this, his knee injury and leg injury, foot injury, whatever you want to call it, that he suffered earlier this year at Daytona. Is it realistic that he could make the chase this year?
Well, we talked about this a little bit, I think, last week, and at the time, I wasn't really sold on it. I thought the Sonoma victory would be a good springboard, but he had a kind of a rough outing at Daytona and just kind of salvaged that and coming home in 17th. But if you look at it now, he's only ran 7 races. He's won 2 of them. He's got 3 top 10s, and he's only 87 points out from 30th in the points right now. And when Cole Witt's average finish on the year in 30th is 28th, that means pretty much all Busch has to do from this point forward is average finishing in the top 15. And I definitely think that Busch is actually capable of that. I mean, he's running great. He's got tracks coming up that he's really stellar at, like Richmond he's good at. Watkins Glen sometimes he's just in his own level at, especially now that Ambrose is gone. And, I mean, there's a legitimate chance that Busch could make it now. I think this win is kind of the definitive moment that pushes Busch from, yeah, it'd be a good story, to, oh, my goodness, this could actually happen. I'll tell you what's crazy is that Busch is within about 150 points of catching Tony Stewart already, who has competed in the whole schedule and sitting 28th in points. So I don't know. I've been absolutely impressed with Busch's work ethic and how well he's done since he came back. And the way things are going for him, I honestly think he's going to make it now.
I agree. I think it's a layup at this point. I didn't expect him to gain like he did this week, and I don't know that he'll do it very much more over the rest of the season. But I told anybody, listen, if he was within 80 with 5 races to go, it was still plausible, but it was going to be difficult. He's at 87 now, and we've got, is it 7 races to go? 8 races to go? It's just a layup, I think. He gained 41 points on Saturday night. If he does that 2 more times, he's only 5 points out, and you'd have however many races left. So I think it's going to be all but inevitable unless he has 2 DNFs over the remaining stretch before the chase, which is possible, absolutely, but I think he's more likely to have 2 more wins than those DNFs. And then is when the hue and cry is going to come off the mountaintops from all the fans. Because I've been quoted multiple times as saying when they announced this rules package that I thought Kyle Busch was the prohibitive favorite to win a championship, because it drew the cup cars back into line with the trucks and the Xfinity cars as far as how you race them. And it was all about momentum and keeping your momentum up. And Kyle Busch has proven that he is by far the master of that in this sport. And so you're going to be going to the chase with this new rule package with the guy that's the best at doing it, and he's going to have a shot to win. And I think the fans are going to lose their minds even before the end of the season. I think if he makes the final 8, forget about the final 4, if he makes the final 8 after missing 11 races, I think people are going to completely flip out.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I'm not even sure the intriguing question anymore is whether he's or not he's going to make it, because I think that's pretty much a foregone conclusion at this point. The way he's ascending up the standings is pretty astounding, and I think it's pretty much a done deal that he's going to make the chase. So I think the more interesting question is whether or not the fans are going to be able to accept the fact that a guy who missed 11 races will possibly be contending for a championship. It's so that's all a matter of perspective. I mean, from my vantage point, NASCAR stayed within the rules as far as dealing with Kyle. You know, I was really happy that they didn't alter any rules or anything like that, or make it so that a driver outside of the top 30 could possibly make it in with a win or anything like that. I like the fact that they made it so that you need to be in the top 30, but I'm very curious to see how the fans react, because unfortunately for NASCAR, they could have another Ryan Newman scenario on their hands this year if Bush ends up making it, where half the fan base thinks that, you know, it's okay and even exciting that somebody, you know, who maybe didn't perform or wasn't, in Kyle's case, wasn't racing for a portion of the season, could make a run of the chase. And there's another half that don't that think it would delegitimize the championship. I would probably cast myself in the first group. I mean, by all accounts, Kyle, you know, if he makes the top 30, will have made the chase fair and square. So I don't know. I think it's going to be so interesting as far as these last eight races go here for the chase, just to see if Kyle, you know, can make the chase. I think he's going to, but I think it's going to still be pretty exciting, because I think it's going to still be close. And once we get in there, can anyone keep him down? Because it's really slowly starting to look like he's the guy to beat right now. So,
well, don't forget, he's driving for Joe Gibbs. And Toyota has shown over the last 5 to 6 races that they have found something in the horsepower department. Their speed has picked up.
They definitely have.
You check the standings after Saturday night, or the finish of Saturday night's race. First, third, fourth, and fifth were Joe Gibbs cars. They are without a doubt in the ring and looking towards being close to being favorites at this point, because the Stewart Haas, Kevin Harvick, Kurt Busch group has slipped a little bit, and the Hendrick guys are kind of hit and miss at this point. Now, Hendrick might be experimenting a little bit. Wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't be their first time doing it. But Joe Gibbs Racing, without a doubt, after Saturday night, has proven that they are going to be a force to be reckoned with before this championship is settled.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with that at all. I mean, even David Ragan, for instance, there was a point in time where Ragan's number 55 Toyota was as high as second in the race. So I think that just goes to show how far Toyota has come this season. And this is going to lead into my last question here. If it ends up being that this low downforce package ends up being applied to the chase races, that could play into Toyota's hands even further. So to finish up here, do we think that that aero package could be seen again in the chase? Mike?
I completely think so. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't announce it in the next week. I think they were happy enough with it. I think there's probably going to be a little bit more of a tweak to it. But the reason I think it'll happen sooner rather than later is that Goodyear had the built-in excuse, we didn't have a chance to develop the right tire or whatever. They're going to announce it now so that when you hit the mile-and-a-half tracks in a chase, Goodyear's already going to have had time to do a tire test and produce the necessary tires to run on the packet.
Aaron?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see it at all. And I also want to note, what a crazy weekend news-wise when we get a truck and a catch fence, Junior ramming Danica into the wall, and Gordon not getting a win at a racetrack, and they don't even make the podcast. What a weekend. But
yeah, seriously.
But yeah, I could definitely see NASCAR doing it. The product was clearly better, at least by Kentucky standards, and I know one race is a small sample size, but if they announce it now and give the teams, and Goodyear especially, as Mike said, time to work towards it, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see that something like this come into play when the chase comes. And really, it could be a huge shift in the balance with everything, with Hendrick and Stewart Haas struggling like they did. So we'll see, I guess. I mean, it'd make things interesting, that's for sure. And quite frankly, I think NASCAR and all of us agree that we just want to see the best product on track throughout the rest of the year. So I really wouldn't be surprised to see them do something like that.
All right. You've heard it from the experts, folks. That's all we've got for this week. Please tune in next week, where myself, Aaron, and Mike will recap all of the action from this weekend's race in New Hampshire. Signing off for myself, Aaron Bearden, and Mike Neff. Take it easy, guys.
Peace out.